Assess sound and data.
Today we have the opportunity of talking to Clarence Barlow, one of my favorite people and just an amazing composer. If you don't know about his work, you should definitely check out his decades of work. I've known him for decades, and he and I always have these very interesting conversations, and his work in sonification is just amazing, and I really usually do a 20-minute thing, but this time I decided to let it go, and we talked for almost an hour. But his last position, I mean, he's done so many things. He was at the Institute of Sonology in The Hague, and he was very involved with Darmstadt in the 80s. Anyway, he was just retired in 2019 from his position as the Korn Endowed Chair and Head of Composition at the University of California at Santa Barbara. And when he retired, he moved to Barcelona, where he's now living. And so I'm talking at quite a distance with him, so we talk about time zones almost at the beginning. But I think you'll really enjoy this. He's an amazing fellow and is just a razor-sharp mind full of all sorts of very interesting ideas. And he's realized so many interesting concepts relative to sonification that so many haven't even really had a chance to look at. So I hope you enjoy this. It's a long one, but it's a really good one.
It's very informal, this thing. I just have conversations. Uh-huh. Like, I had an extended conversation with Pauline Oliveros at one point before she passed. And,
right.
And she and I were very close and did a lot of collaborating in this kind of weird sound and data area.
Uh-huh.
And I've been kind of, all of my research, once I was in Marseille at Emira in 2011. At the doing research in sonification, and that's what really codified that was my research area. And Roger Molina and I just started working together all the time on the idea of sonification. Why wasn't it a bigger thing? You know, what's going on with that? What are the problems? What's the philosophical basis? What are the different types?
Right.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
And he started this thing called Creative Disturbance because of his affiliation with MIT Press.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit now. I want to pronounce this right. Coriolanus? Let's see.
Yes.
Yeah.
Coriolanus.
Coriolanus, which I recognized as an obscure Beethoven overture, right? As I remember.
Yes. Not that obscure.
Oh.
His Coriolanus.
Coriolanus. Overture. We'll get it.
I've known it since I was a child. And
oh, yeah. I've known about it. I hadn't heard it played.
That's what gave me the idea.
That's
what gave the title of his piece and the Beethoven year, 2020, gave me the idea for this piece.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's a fantastic thing, which if you don't mind, I might attach the pointers to the samples that you provided me in the email, just so people can hear the sort of wonderful time scale that the piece is on, because most things in sonification are these very rapid, ever-changing, especially when you're dealing with something like, did you use the DNA or the RNA, I mean, of the coronavirus? Yeah, so you have the ACTG, that's it, you know, so it's usually some kind of bongo, terrible bongo drums or something.
Yeah, except it's not a T, but it's a U, because it's RNA.
Oh, right. Oh, good correction, actually. I didn't make that distinction, but you're right, yeah.
Yeah, I think the T is a double helix, and the I'm forgetting now, and the U is a single helix.
Okay, so this takes me to a spur of this whole thing. Which is, okay, I'm doing sound and data, but I was sort of forced into this sonification thing just because I, as a fan and a accolade, I guess, of Cage, thought of music as a process, music making.
Yes.
You know, the act of composition is procedural. And therefore, I was doing these pieces that were later codified as sonification.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your approach to this as well? Or
Well, I've been doing sonification for decades.
Right. And that's why I thought of you.
And I wrote an article which has been published in English, German, and Spanish even,
uh-huh.
on the visualization of sound and the sonification of image.
Right.
So what I've done is, for instance, taken a photograph of a pianist and made that into a playable score. And if, well, it's very difficult to play, and I told her we will not make a live visualization of your performance because you might distort your own face. But but the idea is, I've done it on player pianos, and I've got a video. I could send you this stuff because I could send you all my sonification stuff. You watch the video.
Yeah.
Page by page, there are 10 pages, and page by page, the pixels appear on the screen corresponding to the notes.
Uh-huh.
So left to right is time, and bottom to top is pitch.
Right.
And there are 88 pixels from bottom to top, because it's a piano piece. And her face gradually appears, because every layer adds one more set of pixels. And about halfway through, you begin to say, oh, wow, this is a face.
Uh-huh.
So the piece actually came from her face.
Uh-huh, right.
So, yeah, so that's what, you know, I mean, for me, sonification is so natural. I've done it so often as well, in different ways.
Right.
That when I thought about the coronavirus and Beethoven, I simply thought, well, this genome looks so much like code. It is code.
Yeah,
so
right.
What I could do is I could convert code into... it is a kind of it's a frequency modulation that I'm doing,
uh-huh.
because I'm simply repeating samples according to the atomic number and I should be reading my own article now. exactly.
I can attach it. It's okay. You gave
exactly.
me exactly.
Yeah. Because the atomic number, for instance, is one of the transposition factors. For
right.
instance. And it's the four atoms, as you know, nitrogen, carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And these four, they have different atomic numbers, and I use the numbers coded to do sample repetition, which cause transposition downwards.
Uh-huh. And you knew that going in, or did you discover that by just...
No, I was trying various things, and at first I tried an amplitude modulation. I tried that,
uh-huh.
and it sounded boring. It just sounded like some sort of a distortion of the Beethoven at very slow speed.
Right.
Not even slow speed. It was supposed to be slow speed because I only took... that's it, I remember now.
The first two chords,
Now just two chords, but when I first started, I took a much longer excerpt of the Beethoven.
Okay.
Maybe about, I've forgotten now, but maybe about the length of the piece itself.
Oh.
I was thinking of a five-minute piece,
uh-huh.
so I might have taken 5 minutes of the Beethoven. And I think the entire overture, is about 7 minutes, if I remember right.
Yeah, and
I took, I think, the whole of it now. Coming to think of it, and I realized that it just sounded like I was putting the Beethoven through some distortion machine, so it didn't sound interesting.
Right.
So I just rethought the whole thing and decided to use frequency as my parameter, and not amplitude.
Right. Well, see, that's the unusual part that hasn't really been codified, relative to sonification. The craft of composition mm-hmm. is actually the fundamental. Mm-hmm. aspect of making a successful thing, and then once you're successful, it becomes so interesting musically that any sort of functional use that some scientists might want is sort of lost. So it's a self-defeating weird problem that explains why the Geiger counter is the only real sonification tool that ever like got any traction. It was invented in 1932, I think, and you know, it's like there's really no use of sonification other than I've heard about a Samsung dryer that plays different melodies on the different wash cycles.
Uh-huh. Oh.
You know.
Well, what I used to do was I thinking of? No, sonification, exactly.
Yeah.
No, not what I used to do.
Yeah.
I know that people have been speeding up seismographic curves and listening to earthquakes, or at least the precursors of the earthquakes, and beginning to recognize when an earthquake is due.
Uh-huh. So, because you can hear the preamble. Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. So they're able to listen to all those curves and listen to the sounds before the earthquake actually bursts out. And they say, okay, so that's what it sounded like before the earthquake. And they keep listening to these sounds, I think somewhere in South America, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, okay,
this
I hadn't heard about
this. I think it invented the technique, and he also called it phonification.
Well, it is, there's all sorts of ways of doing this. I mean, there's ways...
I think you should check... sorry for talking dully. I think you should check seismic sonification.
Okay.
You might find something.
I'll do that. Yeah, that sounds good. Maybe I'll do it right now while we're talking. I'm at a computer, so... Anyway...
Okay, I'll do
but,
that, too.
Yeah, you'll be back. Do you have to go feed the dogs? Or no? That's why I was a little late with the call. Anyway, the real interesting thing to me relative to this is that it's been so unsuccessful, and yet there's so many attempts, but the attempts are always this sort of very simple thing where people turn the graph of into some kind of weird, mountainscape line. Nobody's going to use that, and it's
boring,
bad music.
Boring.
I mean, on top of everything else, it's like bad music like science.
Well, you know what I saw recently? The GEMA, the German Royalties Association,
right?
They sent out a magazine, and I looked at their recent copy, and it showed. It gave us a website to which I went. I can send you that.
Okay.
It's somebody who took the coronavirus genome, so after I'd done it, I think he did it a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And he made such boring, nice music out of it. It was like
almost
pentatonic and pretty. So I wrote to them. They haven't replied. I wrote to them and said, well, my music is not as nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I did one early on too, but I just thought, everybody's going to pile on this. I'm not even going to try to release this. But mine was very ominous sounding, kind of like post-Zanakis, because I was thinking, God, I'm going to die. I'm in my 60s and, avoiding everyone, and I can't see my grandson, and, the whole thing. And it's like, I'm not going to make some kind of forget it. It's like, well, I can't do that anyway, actually, to be honest. I mean, my stuff is always pretty sinister sounding.
No, it's just this. These people, their aesthetics are as poor as they are rich in scientific knowledge.
Well, that's a problem. Yeah, that's a really good...
Exactly.
That's a fear identified what I find to be the most frustrating aspect of all this. And also, art is always in the service of science instead of some sort of collaborative thing where they respect the opinion of the composer and their taste and aesthetics and knowledge. It's a real problem, and it explains a lot about why nothing successful that I can find. I mean, the only way it's ever used is the way this fellow, I think it's from Australia that you're talking about, that did that beautiful rendition of all, blah, blah, blah. It's like this, and it made the world press. Beautiful music made from coronavirus, and it's just this awful music.
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I know of a guy with a German name, and he's probably from Austria.
Okay.
Not Australia, but Austria.
Oh, maybe I miss, my memory. I just, being in the
so,
bleachers
yeah,
like
that,
I am.
Maybe
you know.
People know, yeah. Yeah, but it's so bad. It's so embarrassing.
It really is. I mean, but music in general has gotten a little bit embarrassing. I mean, I'm not excited about much of anything lately. I mean, it's really, and I'm speaking much more broadly than this narrow data thing. Compositionally, I mean. Symphonies are having a hard time staying open because the blue-haired ladies are dying, and and the new music that's coming out isn't being played. I mean, I spent some time. A family friend of Michael Tilson Thomas, and he always avoided me in these dinner parties because he knew I was going to try to get him to look at a score of mine or something, and yet when we finally did talk, he told me about the piece of his called Islands that he was having played, which was, you know, not up to the standard of his teacher, Lucas Foss. You know, it wasn't as interesting or engaging as the work of Lucas Foss, which I found, which I quite liked, actually, back in the day. And, you know, so there's just an example of he identified himself as a maverick. He was very good to Lou Harrison, actually, and played, you know, some parch pieces and stuff like that. But in terms of actual supporting of a new, or commissioning you, for example, when you were in Santa Barbara or something, I mean, you know, it's like, what's that about? I don't get it. This whole use of the symphonic instrument, which is such an amazing human accomplishment, is just going to go away, I think. And it'll just be a museum.
I mean, because it's such an unwieldy instrument, I've only written, I wrote two piano concertos, of which the first is really a youthful, I was a teenager then, and I've got a score somewhere. But the second piano concerto was left incomplete for about 35 years, and then I finished it at the age of 52, and it was performed in Reykjavik, and they want to do it again in Czechia in November, except that I don't know whether it's going to happen because of Corona.
Which is another part of the problem.
I wrote a very big orchestra piece, which was done in Donau, Michigan. In 1989, and I knew that the organizers and the commissioners of the piece would hate it, but a lot of people out there like it a lot, and there's a new CD of mine that just came out. No longer just came out, it's now already about 4 years old.
Well, there's that time dilation again.
Yeah, exactly. I can send you a link to that, and it has the orchestra piece on it.
Okay, so, great.
Yeah, I was very happy to write for symphony orchestra, large orchestra, too.
Right. I mean, it's such a challenge. I know some friends of mine, like Ed Campion he worked on a big piece for the Santa Rosa Symphony, and I was around while he was getting the score prepared, and I realized even with Finale and all these tools to print the parts, I just can't imagine Mahler's Ninth. I mean, what did they do? I mean, that wasn't all Mahler. Yeah. That had to be a team of people that were typesetting and using those very cumbersome typewriters to make those beautiful, even the parts, you know, and all that. It's just a marvelous, like I said, I think of it as an instrument, the orchestra, and it's just going to disappear.
I agree. I mean, if somebody were to offer me a commission, I don't need money. If somebody were to offer me a performance, because it's fun to write a piece for orchestra and then put it away, right?
Yeah, so yeah,
if somebody
I've done
were
that.
To perform it, I wouldn't hesitate, because I love that instrument. I love the orchestra.
Yeah, it's funny. I was playing, I sent you that link, because your piece sort of reminded me of the...
I looked at Ligeti,
It has, you know, they're not the same, but there's some kind of... I think it's the sense of time that's present in your piece.
Yes.
That's also present in the Ligeti Requiem. Just the first movement. I'm not talking about the whole thing. Just that first movement with that kind of
and very slow.
Yeah,
moving.
And it opens
but
up.
I've been influenced by, I think, people like Sibelius, for instance, years ago, who also develops very slowly, and Bartok, I think, in some of his pieces too develops pretty slowly.
Right.
And
I mean, the fugue from organic growth.
The
fugue from the Music for Strings, Percussion, and Celeste is not as slow, but it has a slow development.
Exactly.
And when the violas take the mute off the instrument, there's this like this little bit of brightness that, but if it's an emotional moment. I mean, it has. Well, okay.
That's me. And so this to get back to the main topic, sonification. Why do you sonify when you do so?
Well, it's so weird. I've said this before, but I was really influenced by Cage. I mean, we were doing The Hub, which is basically a kind of a tutor, actually, even more than Cage, the idea of process as a compositional thing. And so I was doing these pieces where I took the digital elevation model from the USGS, and use that as a compositional determinant in a bunch of different ways. I mean, not just not just that. We did do that. But we did a bunch of things. We changed the setting of the reverb based on the distance to the mountain and that kind of stuff. And but I didn't think of it as sonification. I thought of it in this way as, oh, I'm going to use this instead of the I Ching. I'm going to use this geological data and you know,
right.
I did these big, huge, like 4-hour piece, you know, that I performed live on KPFA and, you know, it's all.
Wow. Wow.
But then later I get these calls from these sonification conferences that wanted me to present about this piece. They had heard it and just assumed that I was trying to woo geologists to using data and, you know, blah, 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 which I wasn't at all. And so that's really, that's where I'm coming from, is actually from this compositional place. And I think that's true for a lot of things that are identified as sonification, where the composers, like a Tao Tanaka did something similar to your thing with the pixels that you described. And I talked to him about it, and, you know, I need to interview him for this, actually. But his take on it was just, well, this just seems like a process that would yield interesting sonic results, which I think is a much better way to approach the idea of sonification than some kind of pseudoscience, like, you know.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I agree. Because it's in my case, it's always that I can already imagine the sound, not in detail, but I can imagine what the sonification that I'm about to do would do. And since I've done the opposite too, visualization of sound, it goes hand in hand.
Right. Yeah, that's...
And it's the suitability, yeah.
Yeah, suitability. Though I think the synesthetic aspect of the act of doing this has something to do with the gateway to maybe making it something that's more culturally acceptable. So I've only been able to find one or two people that are making sonifications that are have a functional utility. One is Chris Chafe at Stanford. Has these ways for epileptics to hear the precursor of an epileptic fit. If they listen to this thing, he made he worked with a neuroscientist or a neurophysiologist actually, and they made this monitoring device that epileptics can wear, and they can get some warning that they're heading towards it's sort of like this earthquake thing actually.
Yeah, right. By the way, I checked, and there's plenty out there on the internet. Oh. Seismic sonification.
Yeah. Oh well, and I have a grant proposal with Starvos. God, I can't remember his last name, but the guy who did the gravity waves at Pisa and made the world splash in the news, found that the data that he was dealing with from the radio telescopes was much better to present as a sound. And it's only about an 8-second sound. It's like, you know, that's it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it contains enough detail, and it's much better than a visual representation. That's what they presented. You know. So I think
talking of that.
Yeah.
Talking of the 8-second sound.
Yeah.
I made a 2-second sound, which I use in my lectures, and that is 2 years of air pressure curves. Since the air pressure, the pressure of simply the atmosphere goes up and down every day, I said that's a sound wave. It's just a very low-frequency sound wave.
Yeah, very low.
So let me hear it. So I transposed it to audible frequency, and of course down from the loudness, otherwise I'd have gone deaf.
Yeah.
And... it's a very funny sound, and when you hear it, it's woof, woof, woof. And each of these woof was a stormy period.
Ah.
So you can say, oh, that was October 2000, that was February 2001, and that was September 2001.
Uh-huh.
So, indeed. And then what I did was, I did a Fourier analysis of that particular sound, that 2-second sound,
right,
which is 2 years of weather.
Yeah.
And I discovered sine tones, you could say, 2 sine tone frequencies in that sound, and I was able to listen for them and hear them. One of them is the temperature change of the 24 hours, so you have a 24-hour period,
right,
which makes the pressure go up and down,
right.
And the other one is the tides, because it's a 12-hour cycle. So I could hear these two sine tones in my two-second sound. And they're the tides and they're the diurnal temperature change.
Ah, well, that's interesting. Well, okay, so I should listen.
I'll send you that too.
Oh yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, let's put these all as links there, and I can put them up on a server somewhere. But the thing is, I've been working with Bert Barton. Did you know him in Amsterdam at all? Theater guy. Anyway, he did a version of Faust in the. Anyway, he and I have been working for decades now on this Talking Trees piece. Which is using the same diurnal kind of thing, because it it takes the tree data. We've hooked up with these phyologists, which are biologists who study trees, and they give us their data for a forest, and then we use that and do this time stretch thing, you know, that you have to do for these more natural processes, and. But I haven't listened for those sine tones, and I should do that in the tree data is what I mean, and you know it would it probably would manifest in the same way. I imagine.
Yeah, the only reason why I listened is because I looked at the Fourier analysis, and I've forgotten what the term for it is, something with an M, a Fourier analysis in which you use several fundamentals, one at a time, and then you overlay all the analyses, and they form a nice composite picture. So I think I started with something like, I call it microhertz, so it's somewhere in the, I think it's in the, that's right, one time window per year, and then two time windows per year, three per year, and so on, until you come to the audible range.
Like the Hamming window kind of deal, like by window.
Like that, a variable Hamming window. But there is, I know Curtis Rhodes told me a term for it, and I've forgotten.
Well, he would know.
I wrote software to do, a creaking door. I did the Fourier analysis of that, and I could go down to 5 hertz or something like that, and all the way up to 2,000 hertz, and do a graph.
And then you spotted it. You spotted these sine tones in that.
Yeah, when I did that, exactly, I used this very software of mine to do that with the Cologne weather of 2 years. And I saw these two horizontal lines, and I thought, what could they be? And then I said, wait a minute. And I measured their actual frequency, and one of them had a frequency of 1 day, the other one had a frequency of a half a day.
Well, that...
A period.
That predictive quality, again, could maybe... come to bear on that, the use of it. I mean, I'm just blue skying, but always kind of looking for some sort of use for this sort of thing. I mean, because, I mean, well, another problem, and the two things that came to mind while you were talking. One was, are you still programming in Pascal?
Yes.
That's so great.
It works fine. I use the compiler. It's called Free Pascal.
Yeah.
It's free, and it works on the PC. Yeah. I also use it on the Mac because when I teach, I would like my students to be able to use my software, and many of them have Macs, more than those who have PCs.
Yeah.
So I make sure, I compile it on my Mac and make sure it runs there as well.
Wow.
So it's really transportable.
Yeah. Well, it's a brilliant, it's like, you know, I used Forth early on. And
Lisp.
Remember that. That match. Lately, I've been using Clojure, which is a variant of Lisp that talks to Java, you know. And but I did a bunch of work with David Cope early on in Lisp, I'm more of a maverick with these code thing. I've always admired your sort of adherence to the Pascal thing.
I made a decision. It was about I think exactly 11 years ago, it was the summer of 2009.
Okay.
When I was invited by the people in Bourges, the institute, it was one year before it folded. They invited me to come and spend some weeks in their maison de compositeur. And so I spent about 2 weeks there, and I thought I'd teach myself C. I wasn't interested in C++. So I did some programming every single day in C. And at the end of it all, I said, I'm so slow still. Why didn't I stick to Pascal? And, you know, thinking of my age and how much time I would have left in life, I thought it's not really worth my trying to learn a new language, becoming a baby in it, and, you know, pointers and addresses and things, using them as well. No, I found Pascal great. And the only reason why I moved to Pascal from Fortran in 1984
right.
was because I bought my own computer, and there was no affordable Pascal, no affordable Fortran compiler.
Well, so that's still very rare, one. Yeah. You
yeah,
can get
it was
them.
Very expensive.
Yeah. That was my first language, too, Fortran.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, right. I started in 1970.
Yeah. Well, I was six years behind you. In 76. Oh, no, I guess it was 75. Yeah, I did.
Right. I mean, what's our age difference?
I don't know. I'm 66.
Okay, so you're 8 years younger than I am.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. There you go. Well, anyway.
Oh, I must tell you another little funny thing. I don't know whether it doesn't have any bearing on this at all.
No.
But
no.
I started programming in 1971, to be more precise.
Uh-huh.
And but I was looking at the possibility in 1970. And I wrote my first piano piece that year in 1971 with a computer. And I had an idea for a piano piece which would be pretty crazy in its durations. So 1 second events are the most frequent, and someday I'm going to do a histogram of all the durations.
Oh, great.
And, but half a second and 2 seconds are a little less probable, but they're still possible, multiples of these. I mean, every power of two, they're all powers of two multiplied by an integer, or every duration.
Uh-huh.
The longest of these is several trillions of years. And I just worked out recently the length of the piece.
Uh-huh.
I believe it's something like just a couple of months ago. I finally worked out. So I have this printout here in my very workspace. I'm
uh-huh.
looking at it right now.
Okay.
Printed in Cologne in 1972, and I did an OCR scan of it in the last couple of years, little by little,
uh-huh.
and finally made it into a text file. And I can send you the entire text file as well if you like.
Yikes!
And I worked out the duration of it, and it's something like an American counting, you know, the long ladder and the short ladder.
Right.
In European counting, you say a million is a billion.
Yeah.
And in American counting, it's 1,000,000,000. So in American counting, it's something like 19 quadrillion years.
Oh, that's all. No problem.
Yeah, it's not very long.
Well, we keep coming back to this thing of time scale, which is
yes,
always
exactly.
Which is always the thing with sonification, isn't it? I mean, it's like you're always making some sort of sacrifice
yes.
of either aesthetics or, well, it's usually aesthetics, actually, or just your taste. I mean, your taste makes it go, well, I certainly have to speed this up. If I'm doing it in real time, it just sounds like, you know, it doesn't sound like anything.
Yeah.
But once I speed it up and I put it in a pentatonic scale and I move to Austria, mm-hmm. and then I can get world press on this thing, you know.
I just sent it to a composer.
Yeah.
You know Alvin Curran, right?
Oh, very well. Yeah, Alvin and I
yeah,
toured.
Yeah, he's a
together.
Dear friend.
Yeah.
And he sent out a newsletter recently, and in that newsletter he said, when I was in Halberstadt, the place where the organ is, that is playing...
Yeah.
Cage's thing, you've probably got the same newsletter.
Yeah, I did.
So I wrote to him about my piece, and I said, well, you know, 600 years, we'll look at this piece of mine. So he said, well, you must send it to, and he gave me the name of a composer and
yeah.
the email address.
Yeah.
I wrote to that guy, and that guy said he's very busy. He wrote back to me. He said, very busy now, but you wrote me a fantastic mail, which I'm going to attend to very soon.
Ah.
So he's one of the people responsible for the Cage performance, actually.
Oh yeah, I mean Alvin's the one who told me about the organ piece, where they change the note every year or something, right? As I remember.
Yeah, there are huge gaps. I mean, the gaps in my piece sometimes, you know, they last for millions of years, and then they carry on again. Sometimes it's only a week. Sometimes it's an hour of a gap.
Well, you should definitely compress that all down to 2 seconds. Hey, did you hear about the guy? There's a guy who took the recordings of the Ring. And he turned it into four clicks. I forget his name, but he sped them up and sped them up, and so it was like Das Rheingold.
Yeah, exactly.
And their name belonging on, you know.
Yeah, it's a bit like a technique that I developed about 10 years ago.
Okay.
No, 20 years ago. already.
Oh, wow. God. Well, there
it's,
we go.
It's, yeah. It's a kind of, it's very similar to frequency modulation, but it is not. It is, if I take a sound wave, and I interpolate a sine curve between one sample and the next.
Right.
Imagine this. Suppose you can see two samples in space at the usual 44.1 kilohertz rate.
Yeah.
So one sample has a value of, I don't know, maybe plus 0.35. The other one has a value of minus, minus 0.5 or something like that.
Yeah.
I interpolate a sine curve between the two so that this sine curve shoots up, hits plus 1, shoots down again, hits minus 1, and then up again to the second sample. So that sine curve has a calculable frequency. And I have taken things like Ravel's Bolero and pretended that these were the sine waves between the samples. So I'm able to speed up Ravel's Bolero to, that's it. You know, the whole of the Bolero is just that sound.
All right.
I'll send you that. I'll send you that too.
Yeah, well, that's a, yeah, Bo Derek, I'm thinking of, you know, the Bolero from, what was it, 10? You know, they did this. That's the first time it hit popular culture, the Bolero. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wouldn't be the same if it was, you know.
No, it wouldn't. But I do the opposite. I take then also, I take some short noise and I expand it to a very long melody.
Well, now, I've done quite a few times myself. And did you ever hear the Beethoven's Ninth stretched to 24 hours?
Now, I've heard about it, yeah.
I went to the first performance of it in San Francisco. It was an overnight deal. By the time, you know, the last movement happened at like 6 in the morning. Because it started at 7 in the morning. I guess it ended at 7 in the morning. And we just slept up
there?
And we slept in this loft. And it was...
Wow.
It's exquisite. The guy used some... It was early on, so he used some really, you know, 24-bit thing. The time stretch was very high resolution. It took like 2 months to render. And, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah, you need good resolution.
Yeah, and the sound quality, although it was based on a 44.1 sample, you know.
Yeah,
so that's probably the finest you could do. The interpolation between the new samples was as high a resolution as the original samples. So the spectral reproduction was, you know, you couldn't tell a sample from the things that were rendered, interpolated between samples. And it's
you know,
exquisite.
Curtis told me recently about a program, and he sent me a link, and I'm going to send you that too. There is this software, and I'll just dig it out in my browser.
Okay.
And I'll send that link to you.
Okay, great. About, well, this will be quite an accompanying document.
Yeah, it really stretches. It says, you can test it maybe.
Yeah.
It stretches, because now that I've made this piece, Coronialis, I don't need to stretch things for the near future.
Yeah.
So I haven't downloaded it or tried it, but it's out there in the internet and apparently does it very well. So
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting aspect of it's a recurring theme here, which is this idea of time dilation and its relationship to aesthetic choice. I'm kind of boiling it down a little bit there, but I'm dealing with this constantly when I'm working with this thing and actually talking to people about what they're doing. They're dealing. You know, of course, everybody makes everything play on the white notes or pentatonic and stuff like that, which is kind of a weird travesty, but...
Yeah, that's it. It's so boring. You listen to it and say, my God. Oh,
yeah,
no.
Wind chimes, you know. That's like...
Yeah, exactly. But of course, when my students do things like time stretching, obviously they're into more sophisticated aesthetics, and so they know that they're not going to make it so pretty, like, as you say, wind chimes and stuff. So,
It's an interesting... So there's this interesting chasm. I mean, we have great art and science, but I think it's a complex network. And in order to even be a composer, you have to be at least, I mean, maybe the word isn't scientist, but you have to have, look at you knew the atomic weight of the nucleotides for RNA. I mean, that's not like, but you also know, you know, counterpoint and French sixth modulation is, and you know, all that stuff, which a scientist doesn't
necessarily.
Yeah,
and when I was in college, when I was in college, one of the subjects I studied was chemistry, and I even had a chemistry lab at home.
Uh huh. Wow, that's interesting.
And my parents hated the smells.
Yeah, well, I found this chemistry set from the 50s that included, like, some radium, you know, you could actually, because it glowed in the dark.
Oh, wow.
It was actually, you know, like a giving. And they used to make Fiesta wear. The orange of Fiesta wear was actually, and Paul DeMarinis did a piece where there's Fiesta wear in a drawer above a Geiger counter, and it's a lead-lined drawer, and the and the participant opens the drawer, and the Geiger counter goes off, and then you roll the Fiesta wear back into the lead-lined drawer, so it doesn't trigger the Geiger counter anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway. You know, I wanted to make a musical joke sometime by somehow counting the violinists in an orchestra.
Okay.
Because that would be in German, Geigenzähler.
Uh-oh, here we go.
a violin counter.
Oh, God. Clarence,
your puns,
you know, I think I have a good sense of puns, but you always amaze me that way. Now, there was one other topic, because we're going along here, and I don't want, you know. There's one other topic that one of the big inspirations in my life relative to doing music and everything was intonation. And the discovery by way of Jim Horton of your Euler digestibility index. So, and we've talked about this before, but for maybe we'll make a pointer in this tome that we're going to attach to this interview. But this digestibility index, can you tell the listener a little bit about what that's all about?
Well, it was back in 78 that I wanted to write music. Actually, I started work on the piece in 1975, but in 75 I knew that this piece would be in variable tonality.
Okay.
And I would move very smoothly from atonal to tonal and back. And the same thing for metricism, ametric to metric and back, but talking about tonality.
Yeah.
I then said, well, I've got to be able to measure how tonal intervals are, because even though Hindemith wrote a wonderful book about that and all, I wanted to use microtones, and nobody in the West had described the harmonicity of microtones. So I decided I needed to go back to prime numbers. And when I was looking at intervals, it's fine to say 2-3 interval is very harmonic because it's got small numbers in it. And Harry Pasch never went beyond that. He just said the smaller the number, the better.
Yeah.
But I realized that 6-7 and 7-8 are somehow not good because of the high prime number 7. So I decided that there was going to be a quality of numbers beyond and above size only.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought size and divisibility. So the primer,
so
the
that's
number,
what they call a five limit, right? Five limit intonation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Five limit is the traditional one, and then Parch went on to 17 even.
Yeah.
But three is the so-called Pythagorean system.
Exactly.
Five limit is Rameau, basically, but Glarianus before that, and Aristoxenes in the old Greek, well, he was also talking about a five limit system.
Uh-huh.
So the but I decided to go beyond that, take any prime numbers as factors of ratio numbers, of numerators and denominators of a ratio.
Right.
And take they could be comprised of any prime you like. And I decided I needed to make a formula for that. So I studied my Euler and Gauss and other people and what they did, and discovered that their system wasn't differentiated enough. At least the one of Euler, there are two, Gradus Suavitatis, and the other one's called the totient function. And both of these gave you whole number results for this quality of intervals. And I wanted more differentiability, more differentiation. So in the summer of 78, I came up with this formula, and I'll send you... Actually, do you have my Music Quantics book?
No, I don't think I do, no.
I'll send you that as well.
Okay.
It's about six megabytes.
Okay.
And it has a couple of chapters on my harmonicity.
Oh, okay,
and
great.
And the indigestibility and everything. So.
Right, right. Well, you know, it was an inspiration for me to have this codified. And I used it in a piece that we did with a hub called Listener's Digest, which was a, you know, kind of driven by this concept of digestibility. So it right. goes to undigestible in the middle, and then digestible, you know, goes from fifth down to a unison at the end, you know.
Well, in my case, I'd call it harmonic, and the digestibility is out of the numbers comprising the ratio.
Right, right.
So that the number 13 is very indigestible.
Yeah.
And the number 16 is very digestible.
Right, right. Well,
that's why I use the term.
It was more my sense, not as highly developed as your sense of puns, but in order to call the piece Listener's Digest instead of Reader's
good.
Digest.
Very good.
Anyway.
I'll probably digesting.
yeah, that's true. You will. I know we both will. that's great. Anyway, the bottom line is I have gotten kind of obsessed relative to the sound and data thing, thinking mm-hmm. about intonation as a way of getting to the aesthetic sense of what data inherently has. So in other words, these sort of whole number ratios between large groups of things mm-hmm. could mm-hmm. potentially encode some sort of understanding of the harmonic of the relationship of complex networks. So mm-hmm. this is way beyond just a graph. It's like some kind of sense of, and then I found in the stock market they use this what they call harmonic analysis of the stock market.
Exactly.
And
right.
It's along the same line. So anyway, I'm still working on that. And it's actually was mm-hmm. the thought that made me think of calling you. And then here we get like, you know, 40 minutes into this talk and I suddenly realized, oh, wait, you know, I never even talked to Clarence about the thing that sort of was the reason why I initially reached out. On the day that I had that realization, I said, oh, I have to talk to Clarence. Do you have any thoughts on what I'm articulating there?
Well, you mean using variable tonality? Or
Yeah, just the idea is, do you think there's some harmonic space that just raw data could imbibe, or will it take the intervention of a composer?
I do believe that whole number ratios play a big role in all kinds of phenomena. Now, for instance, do you know what caused the gaps in the rings of Saturn?
No, I don't.
It's harmonic ratios between the orbiting time of the different satellites of Jupiter,
uh-huh.
and let me see what else. Saturn, because yeah. Jupiter plays a role as well. That's a different role.
Yeah.
But in the case of Saturn, it's the orbiting time, the ratio between the orbiting time of the various satellites of Saturn.
Right.
So the first and the second satellites have an octave. I've also got an article which I wrote about that. And I compared my own harmonicity formula to my formula predicts where the gaps will be. You know?
Yeah.
So that's a case of where this happens. I was writing while hesitating a little.
No, that's
and,
fine.
And so that's one of the cases where whole number ratios, it's called the commensurability of orbital times.
Wow.
And so it happens all over the place.
Yeah, right. You know? And that's what I'm finding. And that's why I've got sort of, that's what brought me back around to this. So therefore, if these were turned into musical interval relationships, they would have a digestibility. Mm-hmm. And therefore,
yes.
your theoretical work from 78 would be completely pertinent. I mean, you know, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, that works so nice because when I turn my... I make every satellite of Saturn the tonic of a tonal field.
Mm.
And it goes in both directions. So it goes towards Saturn and it goes away from Saturn. And you have the octave from there and you have the 12th from there and the double octave. You have all these ratios.
Right.
And when I take the first three satellites, Mimas, Tethys, and Enceladus,
right.
and I compare their tonal fields, as a result of gravity being influenced by tonality, by harmonicity.
Right.
I then find peaks in the curve exactly there where the rings have gaps.
Wow.
And then that the same thing applied, this is where I brought Jupiter into the picture, the same thing applied to the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. The gaps in the asteroid belt, there are many gaps, so the asteroid belt is not a belt, but many rings.
Oh, okay.
And the gaps between the rings, these are caused by Jupiter itself. So the position of the asteroid, the orbital time of an asteroid, of any given asteroid, and Jupiter, if it's a very commensurable harmonic ratio, like an octave or a twelfth,
right,
it will cause that asteroid to be destroyed, and it will cause a gap.
Wow. That is like, talk about music of the spheres. I mean, that's like
exactly.
That's the real thing. I mean, you know, Kepler was kind of off when he did his, thinking that it manifested in some. I mean, but on a certain level, the music of the spheres was based on this same intuition that I'm talking about. That there's some kind of harmonic, I wouldn't use the word beauty. It's not even beautiful. It's just perceivable. There's some sort of perceptible
and fascinating.
Yeah, and fascinating. You know, and the kind of dissonance it has tells you something about the relationship that these things have to each other, and therefore, possibly the richest field for sonification. And I mean, just intuitively, I mean, I haven't proved any of this. I mean, there's no proof of any of this. It's just an intuition, you know. But I remember when I was at Emira in Marseille, and I used the term beauty relative to something, and the philosophers there just jumped down my throat. They said, you can't use the term beauty. Beauty doesn't exist. It's not like, you know, this is like a very post-Foucault sort of world where you can't have, you know, the absolute relativism where, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
It's more psychology, isn't it?
Yeah, I exactly,
mean,
yeah.
The constellations in the sky weren't put there for a man to look at and say, wow, beautiful.
Yeah, that
but
looks like a bear.
Random things which, and some of them form random shapes which really appeal to us. So that's a matter of aesthetics.
Right. I did a big, one of the movements of a piano piece after Cage had actually done Atlas Encyclopedicus, but I did a piece using the star map. It's called Star Map, and I did did that as well before I knew I was doing sonification. So you know, I kind of backed up into
wrong,
I backed up into this. You know, it's just like if you're using computers, you're bound to use data and mix sound. I mean, it's just like what happens. You know, so
exactly.
Well, Clarence, you know, we just hit something near 50 minutes here, so that's probably. Okay, Clarence, you stay well.
Thank you, Scott.
My best
you too.
And,
both of you.
Yeah.
Okay, hi for me too.
Yeah, eating breakfast.
Yeah, exactly. We finished breakfast about 4 hours ago.
So you're on a time slip too then.
So, you take care.
Okay, ciao for now. Okay.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
Sound and data.